Well, John Wilkes Booth, that name is infamous, isn't it? He assassinated Abraham Lincoln. And you know what? I knew he was an actor, and that's pretty much all I knew about him. I think I've learned a whole lot more from New York Times bestselling author Jennifer Chavarini. She has a new book out. It's called Fates and Traitors. It's a novel of John Wilkes Booth. She's the author of a number of historical novels, and including Mrs. Lincoln's Rival, Mrs. Grand and Jewel, the Elm Creek Quilt series. So she's got a whole lot of books out there. And in her new book, she paints a picture of John Wilkes Booth through the eyes of four women who knew him well. And it's a fascinating book. I really enjoy reading it, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we go along today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, the email address talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Jennifer Chavarini, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you back. And, you know, I wasn't so sure I wanted to even read the book when I thought, if I really want to read about this guy, I hated him for killing Abraham Lincoln. But I tell you what, I learned a lot. I think I learned a lot because I know how you write your novels. You base them a lot on fact.
Well, that's true. I do like to draw upon a lot of primary sources, memoirs, journals, letters that the historical figures that I use as fictional characters in my book, letters that they exchanged. That gives me, I think, a lot of insight into their personality and their voices and how they interacted with one another.
It's you've had a longstanding interest in that period of time, haven't you? The Civil War period.
Well, that's true. I've always had a fascination with American history, especially women's roles in American history, and I've been drawn to the Civil War era because I find it so rich with storytelling potential. Because when we look back at that time, we see some of the best of what we are as a country juxtapose with the worst of our nature and our history. And I think, too, looking back on that very, very difficult time and seeing how, although it was a very difficult and costly struggle in so many ways, the fact that we were able to survive that and endure that, it gives us hope that we'll be able to face other challenges that we face now in the present and that might come our way in the future.
Yeah. Well, the research you must have done on this one must have been incredible. You were telling it through the eyes of four people, so your research had to be extensive.
Oh, that's right. I like to start with my research at the Wisconsin Historical Society. That's where I get a lot of information of secondary sources as well as some primary sources. And I also like to, in addition to some of the other material I told you about, I also like to look at period newspapers because that gives me a good sense of how my characters would have been learning about unfolding events. I have the benefit of hindsight and all of the scholarly research done upon John Wilkes Booth and these women in his life, the manhunt for him, and what ultimately befell my characters. But when they were approaching, when they were waiting to hear what had happened to John Wilkes Booth, for example, after he assassinated the president and fled Washington, they had to rely upon rumors and news reports as they were just coming in. So by looking at newspapers of the era, it gives me a very good sense of how my characters were experiencing the tension and the turmoil as it was unfolding.
Yeah, I actually couldn't wait to get to that part of the book. I was so interested to see how the family responded to that terrible thing happening to their son or brother or whatever. The four women you chose are probably the four closest women to John Wilkes Booth.
Yes, I chose them because they were important to him throughout his life at various points during his life. But they were also, I think, in his thoughts at the moment of his death, in those last hours of his death. And some of this is based upon eyewitness accounts of those final hours on the Garrett farm when he lay dying. We know from eyewitness reports in memoirs and testimony that his last words were for his mother. It was very difficult for him to speak at this time, but even so, whenever one of the Union soldiers or a member of the Garrett family would come near him, he would ask them to pass on a message to his mother. And by some accounts, his last words were, "Tell my mother I died for my country." I'm sure as a mother, she would have preferred that he live. So that's one of the reasons I chose her as a narrator. Those were his last spoken words. Some of his last written words he actually entrusted to one of his elder sisters, Asia. He had written a manifesto explaining to the world why he was going to undertake this act that he thought was heroic. The rest of the country reviled. And he sealed it in an envelope along with some other important papers and gave it to his sister and asked her to keep it for him in his safe. Now, she thought nothing of this. She didn't know what was in the envelope, but he traveled as an actor. And it made perfect sense to entrust these papers to his sister for safekeeping because as he was traveling around, they could have been lost, damaged, stolen. So she thought nothing of it. It was only after he died that she went back, opened her safe, and discovered what it was he had entrusted to her.
Really, really interesting. I thought that I was interested in how much time you spend a fair amount of time talking about his mother, Marianne, and Junius, I believe, was his dad. And I found that quite interesting because they were so almost polar opposites in terms of their ideals, certainly about the South and the North.
Yes, that's true. I thought that in order to understand who John Wilkes Booth was at the moment of the assassination, I really wanted to understand how he got there. I mean, no one is born with a dream of assassinating a president. Something must have influenced him or directed him along the way for him to come to this moment, especially at that time, to kill the president. Because at that point, the war was essentially over.
He knew it.
There were certainly skirmishes still going on. There were still Confederate armies. And there were some thoughts that maybe the president of the Confederacy was in flight with some members of his cabinet. There was some thought that maybe they could escape overseas and try to continue the war that way or go to Texas and try to mount another attack. But General Lee had already surrendered to General Grant. The Confederate capital of Richmond had fallen. So for all intents and purposes, the war was in its death throes. So you could not really consider this, logically, to be a political act that was somehow going to re-energize the Confederate armies and help them pull out a victory. It just was not going to happen. So to consider this solely a political act just really doesn't hold together very well. So there must have been something else compelling him. There must have been something else driving him to do what essentially would just be a murder that would really accomplish nothing for the South other than revenge.
Yeah, other than revenge, which is pretty much what happened.
Right.
And Junius, of course, I knew nothing about the family or his associates before I read your book. And his dad was a very acclaimed actor.
Yes, that's right. He was a British actor. He made his career start out there and acquired quite a lot of acclaim. But he had reasons for wanting to go to America. One of those, of course, was that after performing so many years in America and also touring on the continent, maybe he wanted to conquer some new ground. Maybe he wanted to prove himself on the stage in America as he had done elsewhere. But he had also fallen in love with a beautiful Covent Garden flower girl. And he wanted to make a new life with her.
And he was already married.
So he could not make a new life with Marianne in London. It just was not going to happen. The scandal probably would have ruined his career. So they flew off to, or they set sail for America and tried to keep their relationship secret for many years. And for quite a long time, they succeeded. Even from his wife. He told her, she had no idea that Marianne existed. She was told by her husband, Junius Brutus Booth, that he was just going to go off and make his fortune in America, and he would send money to provide for her and their son. He was also abandoning his eldest child, and she shouldn't worry. He'd come back to visit when he could. And, you know, when you're a famous actor and you're in the press a lot, and some of your friends from back home also come to America to tour and perhaps perform for you, there's only so long you can keep an illicit relationship like this secret, especially when you have 10 children with the love of your life. Six of them survived to adulthood. So it was not an easy secret to keep, and eventually it all unraveled for Junius and Marianne.
And in some ways for the rest of the family.
That's absolutely true. And I think that this is something that was crucial in developing in John Wilkes Booth's identity. He had a very strong sense of pride with a little bit of doubt underlying it. He was the idea of his illegitimacy at a time when it was very, very shameful and very difficult to be born out of wedlock, I'm sure shaped his character. He had to endure a lot of fist fights on the streets of Baltimore dealing with this when people would taunt his mother. He provoked a lot of fights to defend his mother's honor. And he even tattooed his own initials on the back of his hands when he was a young boy, very crudely in India ink, to, I think, really assert the fact that he was a Booth.
And we'll continue our conversation with Jennifer Cheverini right after the news. Stay with us. I think historical novels are a great way to become familiar with history, and our guest today always does such a wonderful job of bringing history to life. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. In the studio with me, New York Times bestselling author Jennifer Cheverini, talking with her about her newest book. It's called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. I finished it last week, I think, and I really enjoyed it. She has many, many historical novels to her credit. In her new book, you get to see different sides of John Wilkes Booth, what his life was like as a child, how he became the person who assassinated Lincoln. And you may have some questions about him or about the family around him, which Jennifer features in the book. And actually tells the story through the eyes of four women who knew him probably best and who he probably loved the most. You may have questions. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And let's take a call. Dennis in Montello, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I am just wondering if you know what kind of weapon was used to assassinate President Lincoln and what happened to that weapon afterwards.
The gun that John Wilkes Booth used was a small Derringer. He was able to make his way, because he was very familiar, of course, with Ford's Theater because of his acting career. And he had scouted out the place earlier. He had prepared. He knew the scene well. There was a set of double doors leading to the state box where he knew that the president would be with his guests. And there was actually a little hole drilled in one of them that the president's bodyguards had put so that they could peer in and make sure that he was okay and without opening the door to disturb him during the performance. And John Wilkes Booth used that to his advantage. He placed part of a broken music stand up in the area between the doors ahead of time. And so he waited until there was a moment in the play, Our American Cousin, which he was very familiar with, where he knew that the laughter would drown out any sound of his weapon. And he, to prepare himself, he made his way up through the upper balcony, and he opened the first door. He got in, and then he used the music stand to prop the door shut so that no one would be able to come in on him without knocking the door down. And then he waited until that line, and then he opened, and with the sound of laughter drowning out what he was doing, he pulled out the Derringer and shot President Abraham Lincoln at very close range. Mm-hmm. After that, there were two other guests. Well, his wife Mary was with him, and then a younger couple that were their friends. And the gentleman of that couple, he stood up and he was to confront him. John Wilkes Booth pulled out a knife, so there was a second weapon, and he slashed Rathbone pretty deeply along his arm, so he's bleeding profusely. And after that point, John Wilkes Booth leapt down from the state box to the stage, and he brandished the weapon, and he proclaimed his line, "Sic semper tyrannis," and then he either ran off the stage or he hobbled on a broken leg, depending upon which source you consult. I believe, so the Derringer was left behind in the box, and it was confiscated by the authorities. And I believe that it is at the Ford Theater National Historic Site, run by the National Park Service. I believe they have it. It might be with the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress, but I think it is with the Ford's Theater.
Yeah, there we go. And I have to say that chapter is really gripping, and as you read it, you know what's going to happen, but you read it with it's so gripping and with dread almost as you read that particular portion of the book. It's really something. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it. You can join in too with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So Marianna's mother, he was quite close to her throughout his life, was he?
Yes, he was. And it was clear to all the other children that John Wilkes Booth was her favorite son. And he just had this charisma, this charm. He, as a boy, he had such an optimistic outlook on life. He really had a great love of life, was very exuberant, was not the best student. He really struggled with his books, and he had to work very, very hard to learn anything. But as his sister Asia said, once he learned something, he remembered it.
Yeah,
he retained
forget.
It. Yes, but it was a struggle, and he did not want to have to stay in school. But he was what Asia called a dogged scholar.
and his just to bring in the other two, or one of the other characters next. He had a lover.
Yes, and that too, it depends upon which sources you consult. Some sources say that they did not know each other at all, and others say that they were secretly engaged. So when I found that, I thought, okay, this is a puzzle that I'm going to have to solve. And the woman in question is Lucy Lambert Hale, who was the younger daughter of New Hampshire Senator John P. Hale. And like her father, Lucy was a staunch abolitionist, a very devoted unionist, and she was a great admirer of President Lincoln. So this is not a couple that you would think would be drawn to each other, but she was very charmed by all contemporary accounts say was John Wilkes Booth's extraordinary good looks. He was considered very, very handsome. So, of course, a young woman might be swayed by that.
And an actor.
And he was an actor. So if he didn't really love her, he certainly could probably persuade her that he did. And so she was really swept away, according to certain accounts. And I'm sure that John Wilkes Booth did not reveal all of his political beliefs, all of his thoughts to her, or I'm sure that she would not have been able to see any future with him. I think she would have found his views on slavery, of course, rather repugnant, considering what an abolitionist she was. So I think that she kept this secret from him, or he kept this side of himself secret from her, which would have been fairly easy for him to do because he was traveling a lot, and they really only knew each other a few months before the assassination. So I'm forced to think, and I think she probably did too, After the assassination, I'm sure she must have wondered if John ever truly loved her, or if it was all just an act to try to get closer to President Lincoln. Because not only was she this senator's daughter, but she was very good friends with Robert Lincoln, President Lincoln's eldest son, and also with John Hay, one of Lincoln's private secretaries. So she was at the White House quite a lot, and in fact was able to get John Wilkes Booth some pretty nice tickets to the second inauguration. So I can see that she must have always wondered, was she just being used, or did he really have feelings for her?
Yeah. Well, Carl in Green Bay has something. Hi, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I read Bill O'Reilly's book about the conspiracy. Is there any truth to the conspiracy that people, like the senator group led by Thaddeus Stedham, that wanted to punish the South, and that they were upset with Lincoln because he wasn't going to go that hard? He wanted more reconciliation. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah.
That they were involved in the assassination?
Yes.
I have found no evidence in the historical record to suggest that. It is true that there were a number of Northerners who were very concerned that he would take too lenient an approach to the South. There were a number of Northerners who wanted the South, especially their leaders, to suffer for what they had done, for what they had put the entire nation, North and South, through. And it was fairly well known that Lincoln was planning to be merciful and generous in Reconstruction. In a matter of days before he was assassinated, he was at City Point, Virginia, at the headquarters of General Grant, and he was meeting with General Sherman and one of his admirals and others. And the terms that he told them to extend to any generals who surrendered to them strongly indicate that he wanted to be merciful. He wanted to focus on rebuilding, not on punishment. And that is, in fact, one of the reasons why so many people in the South were very alarmed when John Wilkes Booth assassinated Lincoln. Until the day that happened, Lincoln had been their enemy. But they knew, certainly there were many people in the South who celebrated, just as John Wilkes Booth did. But they knew that whereas Lincoln was planning to be compassionate and generous and focus on bringing the divided nation together, his vice president, Johnson. Was not by any means planning to do that. So a lot of politicians and people who knew the men from pre-war experience and working with them were very apprehensive when they realized that there was going to be a President Johnson deciding their fate. And it was not only the former Confederacy who was worried about this. Whereas President Lincoln had made it very clear that he was going to start extending even more rights to African Americans, Johnson had absolutely no intention of doing that. He wanted those demarcations between race and status to be kept very, very clear. So there were a lot of people in the South who were deeply grieved and genuinely sorry that Booth committed this act.
Yeah.
That night.
But for a conspiracy, that you found nothing.
I found no evidence to suggest that, no.
Carl, thank you for calling. I want to give Ron a chance to join in from La Crosse. Ron, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I heard that sometimes when Lincoln attended previous performances at Ford's Theater or maybe any other theater that John Booth performed at, that Booth, if he was in the cast, if there was a line, a threatening line, threatening harm, or some sort of vendetta, say in a play by Shakespeare, he would, if the president was attending, he would face the box where Lincoln was sitting, and he would look at Lincoln while saying this line. Maybe it was Julius Caesar. I heard it somewhere. They didn't elaborate what play it was. Do you know? Would your guests know anything about that?
Well, there's one report that I recall reading, and I think the play was The Marble Faun. I'm not sure if that's true. And whether the story is true or whether it's apocryphal, it's hard for me to really know. after the assassination, of course, lots of people came out with stories that they remember, and they're only as credible as the narrator. So, you know, but one story is that during a performance of this play, John Wilkes Booth, whenever he had particularly angry lines, he would direct them toward the state box. And a woman who was sitting in the booth with him, or in the state box with him, did say, "Boy, he seems to be directing that. He seems to be speaking directly to you when he's saying that." And the president says, "Yes, he does seem to be a little rather angry with me, doesn't he?" But whether that actually happened or whether it's a story that came about later, it's hard to say. I think you might be thinking of Julius Caesar in the fact that that was a play that was in one particular performance in 1864. John Wilkes Booth performed in a special production of this play to raise money to build a Shakespeare memorial. And he was in the cast with his brother, Junius Brutus Booth Jr., the eldest of the children of Junius and Marianne, and his elder brother, Edwin. And this was the only time that the three Booth brothers, who had followed in their father's footsteps, performed on the same stage together. And so it's possible that's why Julius Caesar is, that might be why you're recalling that play in particular.
And the Fates and Traitors, the title of your book, sort of is a nod to Shakespeare and to the, is it not?
It is, indeed. Shakespeare played such an important role in this family. Junius Brutus Booth was, senior, was a renowned thespian, performed a lot of Shakespeare. And so the children, all six of the children who lived to adulthood, were steeped in it. They learned Shakespeare at their father's knee, as Asia wrote in a memoir. And certainly so many of the elements of the Booth family story takes on aspects of Shakespearean tragedy.
Yeah. Thank you again, Ron, for calling. I want to give Nancy in Milwaukee a chance. Nancy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. This Mr. Rathbone, who was in the booth at the time Lincoln was shot, was there with his then fiancée, but later he did marry her. And I believe about 15 or 16 years later, he ended up murdering her. And I'm wondering if the author feels that possibly the mental breakdown of Mr. Rathbone came about eventually as a result of seeing this horrific murder of Lincoln himself.
Yeah.
The trauma of that might have contributed to it, but I don't know if that could be the entirety of it. And I said Mr. Rathbone only because I'm embarrassed to admit, but I'm going to do it anyway, that he was an officer, but I can't remember his rank. I think he might have been a lieutenant, so I might have been a captain. But that's why I called him Mr. Rathbone. I should have referred to him by his military title. So it's true. They were also, he and his fiancée were also step-siblings. They did not, I believe, grow up as children together, but their parents married, and then they, for second or third marriages, but they, so they were step-siblings, and then they fell in love and became engaged. But I think it would be too much for such a horrific act. I think it would be too much to put all the blame on witnessing that particular act, in which really Rathbone was quite heroic in his in the way he rose to confront an armed man. I mean, John Wilkes Booth still held that gun. It just didn't go off. That's why he flung it aside and pulled out the knife. But Rathbone was really ready to defend the dying president and Mrs. Lincoln and his fiance. He rose to that challenge, and unfortunately he was not able to, after he took that very serious knife wound, he was not able to restrain Booth, and so Booth did manage to escape Ford's Theater.
I did not remember, I know that I ever heard that originally, and this comes in your book, that he was planning to kidnap Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, that is how the plot originally began. John Wilkes Booth was a staunch Confederate, and as the Confederate armies were becoming depleted during, of course, casualties, disease, and just desertions as the war seemed to be inevitably that it was drawing to a Union victory. He thought that if all of those Confederate prisoners could be freed, they would return to the South. The Confederate armies would suddenly have this resurgence of soldiers and energy, and they might just be able to defeat General Grant and General Sherman and all of their armies. So he thought that if they could kidnap President Lincoln, the North would, of course, be willing to release all of their prisoners of war in exchange for this one essential individual, President Abraham Lincoln. And the plan was to try to kidnap Lincoln as he traveled between the White House and his country retreat at the Soldier's Home, really not very far away from the White House. It wasn't a very far journey, but it was through some deserted country roads, and much to the consternation of Mrs. Lincoln and Lincoln's guards, he did not want to travel surrounded by armed men. He preferred to travel on horseback alone, and so it seemed like, you know, this might actually work. They could kidnap him and spirit him off to Richmond and then pull something out that might actually rejuvenate the Confederate armies, but it just never could come off. It's a pretty wild scheme, and I really don't know if Johnson had been in charge of that decision, he might not have, you know, he might have said, well, you know, Abraham Lincoln would probably be willing to sacrifice himself, but since the kidnapping plot fell through utterly, we have no way of knowing how it would have played out.
The fourth woman that we've talked about, three of the women that you, and the fourth was Mary Surratt, is her name?
Yes, Surratt. Mary Surratt, yes.
And she was, got to know Booth, and I guess her place was where they met several times.
Yes, that's true. She was, of my four narrators, she was the only one who really shared John Wilkes Booth's political views. She, like John Wilkes Booth, she was a Marylander, and she had run the, after her husband's death, she had run the Surratt Tavern, which was a Confederate way station. It was a safe house for Confederate couriers and spies traveling between the Confederacy and the Union. And so it was she was very clearly supporting the Confederate cause. One of her sons was one of those spies and couriers, and another was off, her eldest child was off serving in one of the Confederate armies, and she had no idea where he was, if he even still lived. But eventually, her financial situation became so precarious that she had to rent out the tavern and move to another building her late husband had purchased, which was a boarding house in Washington, D.C. And her plan was to live there and rent out the rooms and somehow get by and support her children. And it really rankled her to be there in the Yankee capital. She could not, where people were celebrating Union victories and where she had to grit her teeth as people were saying terrible things about her beloved South. But she ran the boarding house where a number of the conspirators resided when they were in Washington, D.C. And also it was an inconspicuous place for John Wilkes Booth and some of the conspirators to meet. So as Johnson said, she kept the nest where the conspiracy was hatched. I'm paraphrasing him, but you can get a sense of Johnson's take on Mary Surratt.
And she was hung for it.
She was the first woman hanged by the U.S. federal government.
Well, you have written a fascinating story here, Jennifer. I really much enjoyed the book, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Always great to have her come by, and she's got another book, I'm sure, in the works, and when that comes out, I'm sure she'll be back to visit with us again. Jennifer Cheverini, the title of her book, Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. Take a look at it. And thank you so much for listening. Garden Talk coming up tomorrow on the show, but in the meantime, there's lots more in store here this afternoon, so I hope you'll stay with us on the Ideas Network.